Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, all, it's Kimberly. Kai and I and the rest of the crew are on a bit of a holiday break. And if you still want to get your Make Me Smart fix, we're sharing some of our favorite episodes from the past year. Before we get to that, though, I was hoping you could help us hit our end-of-the-year fundraising goal. Your contribution will really make a difference in our nonprofit newsroom and in the lives of millions of listeners who rely on us. Please make your donation today at makemesmart.org/givesmart. Or click the link in the show notes. Thank you so much for your support. And now, on to the show. Hello, I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday. We're doing a single topic today. We're going to talk about solar geoengineering. We talked about it a little bit when we had Neal Stephenson on, sci-fi author extraordinaire, as I hope you know. And it kind of comes up when you talk about climate change and solutions and or mitigation. So we're going to talk about that today.
Right, because generally speaking, when we're talking about geoengineering, it's basically this idea that we can, you know, fiddle with the Earth's climate system a little bit. Well, actually, on a very large scale. Tweak at the edges, maybe interfere in a big way. One form of that is solar geoengineering. And that's basically this idea that you reflect the sun's rays away from the Earth. And, you know, what could possibly go wrong there?
Well, now you know. Anyway, here to make us smart is climate journalist Elizabeth Colbert. She is the author of Under a White, among many other things, by the way. Most recently, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Solar geoengineering. Give us a little bit of how it might work, would you?
Well, the idea is as Kimberly explained, that you reflect some of the sunlight that would be normally hitting the Earth with reflective particles. You put reflective particles up into the stratosphere and they would bounce some of that sunlight back to space, and that would have a cooling effect. And the reason that we know that this, you know, works, quote unquote, is that that's what major volcanic eruptions do. They pour a lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere. It's got to get all the way up into the stratosphere. That floats around, creates this kind of haze of little tiny droplets that are very reflective. And so after a major eruption, you do get global cooling for about a year or so.
Is that going to happen with this latest eruption we recently had near Tonga?
I think that the sense is that that was not a big enough eruption.
So the catch, of course, is limiting it to a less solar radiation for only a year, right? Because you put stuff up to block the sun and you block the sun.
Well, the way that most of these schemes for solar geoengineering work, you would have to be constantly replenishing that. Now, they don't, you know, they just block a tiny fraction of the incoming radiation. You wouldn't want to block all of it, certainly. Let's put it that way.
But enough to make a difference, I'm guessing. The title of your book actually refers to what the world might look like if this were to actually happen. Can you describe sort of what it might look like if we were to go outside in a world where solar geoengineering was happening?
Well, there have been, you know, sort of calculations done as to what the sky would look like if we did solar geoengineering, and they indicate that the sky would become whiter, and therefore we would. So now, if you go to a place where now there's a very blue sky, there would be a kind of milky or white, like, you know, like we have in a lot of urban areas where we are not seeing a clear blue sky, you know, without solar geoengineering. But that would be sort of everywhere, all over the planet.
The catch, of course, is that you have to do this on a planetary scale. So literally scale becomes a challenge, right? It has to be a planetary effort. We can't just do it here and say, OK, the United States is covered. Thanks.
No, it would. It once you sort of the whole idea, right, is once you shoot this stuff into the stratosphere,
right,
that it floats around on these stratospheric winds, it would become, it would be global, and as you say, it would kind of have to be global.
And what are the downsides of this?
The list is very long. Some people keep lists of downsides, and they range from, you know, changing the color of the sky potentially, to changing regional weather patterns potentially. So if you are pouring a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, as we are, and heating up the world, and then trying to counteract some of that heating by putting reflective particles into the stratosphere, you don't get sort of the same world. You get potentially quite a different world with potentially different weather patterns. That could be potentially very dangerous for some parts of the world. You are literally getting less incoming solar radiation, so that affects, you know, all of our plans to move to solar power, for example. I don't think that people feel there will be much impact on crops, because plants actually kind of like diffuse sunlight. I think that there are, the other huge potential impact is if you keep, you know, pumping carbon dioxide into the air, and even if you're mitigating the temperature change with some kind of reflective haze, you're still acidifying the oceans, changing the chemistry of the ocean. So that's another huge problem that we have. And, you know, finally, people would say, if you just dangle out this proposition sort of in front of the world, which seems very reluctant to cut its carbon emissions anyway, you're just going to take away sort of whatever, you know, political pressure there is right now to reduce emissions, and we're just going to continue to emit at these, you know, really tremendous rates that we're emitting right now, and we're going to sort of guarantee eventual disaster. So there's a big push among a lot of scientists. There was just recently an open letter from a bunch of very eminent scientists saying, don't even look at this technology. We should not even be entertaining it. So there's a lot of potential problems that run from, as I say, the political to the geophysical.
Well, that's kind of it in a nutshell, right? That last little bit there, the moral hazard on a planetary scale. I mean, you thought, you know, not you, but one thought, you know, the Fed and Wall Street were a moral hazard. This is extinction level moral hazard.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I want to say I think it's a very, very difficult question. There are, you know, very few technologies out there that, you know, we say you cannot even look at this. Some other people on the other side, other scientists would say, well, we really ought to look at it to know, you know, if it's infeasible, if it's just completely infeasible, we ought to know that now too. So it's sort of a double-edged sword, you know, should we be researching it or not? But the moral hazard argument, I think is very powerful. On the other hand, you know, people make the point, and when I say people, I do mean people who are, you know, very knowledgeable and spend a lot of time thinking about this, that, well, we're really not doing anything anyway right now. You know, I mean, emissions are going up. They're still going up when we know they need to be declining dramatically every single year. So, you know, moral hazard, you know, how could you do worse than we're doing now?
I guess that leads to my next question, which was, why are scientists focusing on this right now? But I guess it's pretty self-evident because of the level of the crisis.
Well, and I also do want to say that scientists, I mean, one of the things I learned in writing Under a White Sky was that this idea surfaced right away. Basically, as soon as people, you know, understood that we were changing the climate pretty seriously back in the 70s, really, this idea immediately surfaced. Okay, we changed it one way. We can try to counteract that by, you know, throwing something into the stratosphere, a la volcanoes. So it's really a pretty actually old idea, and it has run into such opposition in terms of research that we have yet to have any really, you know, rigorous tests of whether it is even, you know, remotely possible.
Well, that's a really good question. Can we test it?
Yeah, so that is another really interesting question. I mean, The first test that was planned was actually for this past summer, the first sort of really actually, you know, rigorous scientific tests was just to sort of test some instruments to see if we put some very small amount of particles, you know, into the stratosphere, we could kind of track them and see how they behave, because the stratosphere is, you know, pretty underexplored place. Hmm. It's hard to get to. But, you know, I think that one argument that would be made is, you know, you could certainly test it on a very small scale and get a pretty good idea of, you know, what impacts it would have. But you could also, once again, if you were an advocate of doing this, which, you know, I am not advocating it, I'm just explaining it, you could sort of ramp it up. You wouldn't have to go full scale. You could, you know, have a very slow buildup and sort of see what happens, because the amount of stuff you put up there is right, the amount of right. cooling you're going to get out.
How much money is going into this kind of research and these experiments? And, like, how does that compare to other types of geoengineering and the money going in that direction?
I don't think there is a tremendous amount of money going in right now, unless there are, you know, to be honest, you know, secret government programs somewhere, which there could be that I just don't know about. No, it's a very, you know, it's a serious, yeah. you know, possibility. If you're the U.S. military or, you know, the Chinese military, I don't know what you're doing. But in terms of, you know, publicly announced funding, there isn't a tremendous amount right now. Probably the best funded group is a group at Harvard, and they maybe have, you know, $20 million in funding, something like that. But there was recently a report from the National Academy of Sciences that did recommend a research effort on the order of $100 million or so.
So where do you think this goes? I mean, because $100 million is a boatload of cash, yes, but to the scale of this problem, it's not even couch cushion change.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think that we're just going to hear more and more, and that I don't think we're not researching it, because it's the bottom line is that we have very, very few tools when we decide, which I'm afraid we're going to decide, that we really don't like the damage we've done to the climate. I don't think people appreciate how much inertia there is in the system, how very, very difficult it is to roll things back. And carbon dioxide removal, which used to be sort of lumped in with geoengineering, and now is pretty, you know, considered pretty mainstream. You know, we just keep sort of passing over these thresholds, and then we keep going. And so I do think you're going to be hearing more and more about this, and potentially seeing more and more money going into research. That's just, you know, one woman's opinion.
Well, but a deeply informed woman she is. Elizabeth Colbert is her name. Her most recent book is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, Solar Geoengineering and a bunch of stuff. Elizabeth, thanks a lot. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Man, tough problem. Tough problem.
Yeah, and it's a problem that we're probably going to end up having to throw everything at.
For sure.
And so, look, especially after reading Termination Shock, there are so many. There are so many moral hazards with this concept. And, you know, in the book, they lay out, like, you know, you shoot sulfur dioxide into the air in one place and it causes a massive drought in, like, India's breadbasket or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there are people who end up controlling these technologies, you know, effectively might end up picking the winners and losers in, you know, the global climate crisis. But, you know, I guess that's why it's important we talk about it now.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. Tell us what you think. Are you looking forward to a future with solar engineering or other kinds of geoengineering? Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UBSMART. Or you can leave us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
And we are back. Yes, we are. I lost my
miracle
place in the script.
Of audio production. Did you really? Well, this thing gives it to you. You know where we're going.
I know. I lost all my screens. Okay, it's time for the news fix. Kai, you go first because I clearly don't have my life together.
No, that's fine. But you've got the better story. So I'm going to blow through mine real quick, just lay down a couple of markers, and then we can get to yours, which I think is arguably the news of the day. So number one, the producer price index came out this morning. Producer prices, of course, being inflation at the wholesale level, up 1% month on month in January. That is a lot. It's like 10.5% year on year. Again, this is inflation at the wholesale level. It's a boatload of price increases, but I'm just going to put a stake in the ground and say this. I still don't think the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates a half percentage point in their March meeting. I think they're going to stick to 0.25%. I mean, there's no doubt that rates are going up. I just don't think that they're going to go 0.5%. And I just want to lay down that marker. That's number one. Number two, and this is interesting and bewildering, and I don't know why I picked it, except I think it needs to be noted here somewhere. So Elon Musk, he of SpaceX, but more importantly in this case, Tesla, gave away $5.7 billion of Tesla shares last year to charity. Now, we don't know where it went, but giving away $6 billion makes him, like presto changeo, one of the biggest philanthropists in the world. And that is of note because he is trying to change the world. And I just want to get that out there. People might have missed that. That's what I got.
Yeah,
Yes.
Billionaires giving away money is such a fascinating topic in general. And the way that we rely on the super wealthy to fund some of the things that, depending on, you know, where you sit on the political spectrum, that may be investments for government to make or social safety net supports. And so I will be very fascinated if we ever find out where this money went.
You have to believe some enterprising reporter at like Bloomberg or the Journal, where they've got the resources to dig into this stuff, is going to figure it out. Right. I mean, he or she is going to put two and two together and go down the money rabbit hole, like somebody like David Fahrenthold at the Post or something. No, he's at where
is he
now?
He's
at the Times.
On nonprofits
he's
now.
At the Times, right? Isn't he at the Times? Didn't he get a job at the Times? David Fahrenthold?
Yes.
Anyway.
Focusing on nonprofits.
Yeah. Yeah. So philanthropy is and especially to Kimberly's point, philanthropy by billionaires, when arguably it ought to be the government's job, is a valid social policy issue. Speaking of social policy issues, how's that for a turn?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could draw the direct line. Yeah. You know, you have billionaires like, I don't know if Michael Bloomberg is still a billionaire, but a very wealthy person who spent a lot of...
Bloomberg terminals are like $24,000 of, you know, pay period or something practically.
Right. And this is somebody who spent a lot of his money on gun control issues, which leads to the big story today, which is that the Sandy Hook families, nine of the families, I believe, have reached, they say, a $73 million settlement with Remington, which manufactured the gun that was used in the Newtown shooting that killed 20 kids and six adults in, you know, one of the early, unfortunately not rare, mass shootings in schools here in the U.S. This is hugely significant because I don't think ever has one of these gun manufacturers actually faced any kind of liability or consequences mm-hmm. linked to one of these mass shootings. And it's interesting how they did it, because federal and sometimes even state laws often protect the gun manufacturers for say, a wrongful death lawsuit or something like that. And so what these attorneys and the families did was they actually went after the marketing strategies and the way that Remington marketed this weapon and allegedly targeted young people. And that is why they feel like Remington has liability. And it seemed to have worked. And apparently also as part of the settlement, Remington is going to be forced to release some documents about how it marketed these weapons. And so, you know, and Remington, I believe, is already bankrupt. Yeah. Or at least filed for some version of bankruptcy. So really, this is also the insurers that insured Remington that are going to be paying up for some of this. And so the families, at least, I was watching the press conference earlier, are saying that this is a warning to not only the gun industry, but also the insurers and the shareholders mm-hmm. that there may be some liability, whereas before there has been none. And this is just hugely consequential. I can't imagine what it feels like for those families. And, you know, does this mean it's going to open the door for the, God help us, hundreds and hundreds of other families who've gone through something similar?
Yeah, I don't know. Huge story, though. Huge story. I'm glad you picked it. Glad you picked it.
Yeah.
All right, mailbag, shall we?
Hi, Make Me Smart team.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
I love that sting so much. That might be my favorite sting ever. Okay, so we start the mailbag today with a voice memo. We talked last week about Brian Flores, the former head coach of the Miami Dolphins, his lawsuit against the NFL for racial discrimination and the sad state of affairs about race in the National Football League, and also the Rooney Rule, which remembers that rule that requires, nominally, minority candidates be interviewed for head coaching and front office jobs. Here's the voice memo.
Hey there. My name is Chris from Asheville, North Carolina. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm always amazed at how we can still be shocked at the level of racism that flows within our society. When you think about it, we are only 60, 70 years removed from being a segregated country. And you know, it's hard to see any change when the people making the rules are all still older white men. You know, it is a shame, but thank you.
Yeah, that was arguably one of my favorite Tuesday shows that we've ever done. It was deeply informative. It was incredibly substantive, and it mattered a lot. I thought I really enjoyed talking to Professor Duro.
I certainly learned a lot. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I agree with Chris, but on the other hand, I think we is doing a lot of work there.
Yeah, you're not shocked at all, right? I mean, you know.
No,
right? Yeah.
And I don't think any Blackbirds in America is shocked. And like, I get the sentiment, I hear this a lot. It's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we're still here, but like, segregation is not over. We're not 60 or 70 years removed from being a segregated country, and many, many aspects of our society, it's still deeply segregated. And I think you and I had a version of this conversation when the Black Lives Matter protests started. And I don't remember if it was online, on air or off air, but, you know, this idea of it says something when somebody is shocked, you know, that you didn't see it before. And, you know, that's great that people learn and they grow, but you also then have to investigate why certain people don't see it. So, But yes, Chris, it is a shame for sure. Yeah. Next voice memo. This one is about Justin Ho and his love for Lowe's, specifically as a pit stop when you're on a road trip.
This is Mark from Mountain View. And to add a coda to the search for retail establishments with nice restrooms, I wanted to add that perhaps the nicest public restrooms that are clean and frequently enhanced with potpourri are available at Bed Bath & Beyond.
Oh, my God.
Never fail. Thanks for making me smart. Take care.
That's a little TMI, I'm telling you. That's a little TMI right there. I just didn't even need to know that. Oh, my God. I suppose
they have those little things with the sticks in them that smell nice everywhere.
Send us your travel tips, COVID or non. And also, it doesn't have to be about bathrooms. Send us your suggestions, your thoughts on travel. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Call us if you like, 508-UB-SMART. Those are all letters, UB-SMART.
And we're going to leave you with today's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? This week's answer comes from Sarah in Columbus, Ohio.
Here's something I thought I knew that I later found out I was wrong about. I'm a huge weather nerd, and for the longest time, I thought that the National Weather Service knew pretty much what weather was happening anywhere in the United States at any given time. Then I took a spotter class, and they spent a lot of time telling us how little they really know about what happens at ground level. Because radar and satellites are their main data collection methods, and those don't get down to the ground. So they need a lot of help from volunteers to tell them what's happening on the ground so they can correlate that with the satellite and radar data. Whatever level of help you're willing to give, they would love to have it, because as we get deeper into the climate crisis, their models get less and less accurate.
That is cray-cray. That is cray-cray. That's like 19th century stuff, man. We still have people on the ground calling the National Weather Service saying, hey, it's raining. That's amazing. That's amazing.
So what, do you just like go online and sign up to be a contributor?
But one of our crack producing team is going to find out and put it on the show page, because people need to know about this. That is crazy.
Well, I certainly learned something new today. Sarah.
No joke. That was awesome. That was awesome. And that's why you tune into this podcast. All right. We are done for today. Samantha Fields and I are back tomorrow answering your questions on What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. And if you do have questions that you need answered, you know how to get a hold of us, right? Email, voice memo, all that good stuff.
All the things.
All the things.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our team also includes producer Marque Green. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Jake Cherry engineered the program today. First time down the chute, right? Charlton Thorpe keeping a close eye there on the other side of the glass. Juan Carlos Torrado is going to mix it down later. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer of this podcast is Bridget Bonner. Donna Tam is in charge of everything. Actually, Neil Scarborough, who's the vice president and general manager, is actually in charge of everything. Donna's just in charge of us. That's all.
Yes.
That's all. That's going to have to suffice, Donna. Just be in charge of us.
It's all power.
That's right. Oh, man.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.